Open up there. Leave it open. We're going to spend the bulk of all of our time within this passage. There will be a couple times we deviate, but by and large, we'll stick to this text. I want to begin by reading it. I'm reading out of the New King James Version. As I teach, I'm going to be teaching out of the ESV, and you'll be able to compare. I think the ESV does a very good job translating, especially in the book of Psalms in particular. Psalm 25, verse 1. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. On you I wait all the day. I remember, O Lord, your tender mercies and your loving kindness, for they are from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth nor my transgressions. According to your mercy, remember me, for your goodness' sake, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he teaches sinners in the way. The humble he guides in justice, and the humble he teaches his way. All the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth, to such as keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. Who is the man who fears the Lord? Him shall he teach in the way he chooses. He himself shall dwell in prosperity, and his descendants shall inherit the earth. The secret of the Lord is with those who fear him, and he will show them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he shall pluck my feet out of the net. Turn yourself to me and have mercy on me, for I am desolate and afflicted. The trouble of my heart have been enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look on my affliction and my pain and forgive all my sins. Consider my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with a cruel hatred. Keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Remember Israel, O God, out of all their troubles. The book of Psalms has always held a very special place within God's people. A lot of times we turn to the book of Psalms in difficult times. I think about the words of James in James chapter 5 and verse 13, if anyone suffers, let him pray. If anyone is cheerful, let him sing a psalm. If anyone is sick, let him call for the elders. There's three situations you find yourself in: suffering, cheerful, and sick. Okay, we're going to talk about the first two tonight, the concept of suffering. When David writes this psalm, he pens it, he is in the midst of great trial. There are words of comfort for similar trials, and I would say trials in general that we face, for suffering as we go through life. The book of Psalms is filled with songs of praise. One of the things, if we neglect the book of Psalms as a whole, we do it to our detriment, for we have nothing to sing about in the good times, and we don't have modeled prayer to lean upon in the difficult times. And what we're going to do tonight is focus in on the psalm and understand what's going on. What I want to do is not just teach the content, but also want to hopefully model for us how to study the Psalms. And I'm going to start off by giving some helps or some keys to how we interpret Psalms in particular, in general, and this psalm in particular. You might notice that as you read Psalm 25, he begins with a cry for help, and then he comes down to the end, and he also concludes with a cry for help. And so when we recognize that, we generally assume this is a psalm of crying out for help and assistance from God. And I wouldn't argue with that, but that's not the main focus of what this psalm is about. This has a special structure to it. I want to say this: when you go to the Bible, whether we're talking about narratives or poetry in particular, we need to be aware of structure, because how the writer says lends toward what he is saying. Whenever we can understand structure, we can have built-in divine keys of interpretation that help us to understand the message and make sure that we're on the right track. The Bible uses what's called parallelism all the time. There's four different types of parallelism. But when we recognize parallelism, it's very helpful in self-interpreting. This is what's called a chiastic structure or inverted parallelism. And what you have is the psalm begins and ends in the same place.
Step number two mirrors step number six. Step number three mirrors step number five. And all by itself in the middle, which is the focus of the psalm, the focus is not on suffering, but the God who is there in the midst of suffering. And that transforms how we view the psalm as a whole. Is our focus in times of trial on God, or is it on our suffering?
I have to confess, a lot of times when I have faced difficulties in life, I tend to focus on me. I tend to focus on my difficulties.
And what David is doing by inspiration is helping place the focus where it has to be if we are going to endure and benefit from the trials that beset us in life.
Now, if we could read Hebrew,
we would also recognize that Psalm 25 is an acrostic psalm, meaning each verse begins with another letter of the alphabet. In other words, what David has done is he has sat down and he is thinking through his trial in an A to Z type of fashion. This is very intentional in how this is designed.
And if we could read Hebrew, we would appreciate that a little bit more than what we do.
He has several terms that he refers to multiple times. I want to say this. A lot of times we go to the Bible and we do word studies. And there are benefits in word studies. We see the contexts and the regulation of certain terms as we go throughout the Bible, but we make a mistake if we limit ourselves to the terms, because there are also thematic themes that go along in passages. And you have multiple words that are used, not repetitively, but interlocking or in relation to one another. So I point out that many times in this psalm we have the topic of forgiveness arising, the concept of the way, the path, or the truth of God, and salvation or deliverance.
Those are not the specific terms that are used, but they are themes which repeat. Specific terms that are repeated are the concept of shame in verses 2 and 3 and verse 20. You might notice that the concept of shame begins and ends the psalm. You have the concept of enemies in verse 2 and verse 19. The concept of waiting on God, verse 3, verse 5, and verse 21. The concept of humility in verse 9, it's repeated there twice. You have a term that's difficult to translate from a Hebrew Bible, the term hesed. And we'll talk about that momentarily, verse 6, verse 7, and verse 10. You have the term covenant in verses 10 and 14. The concept of affliction, verse 16 and 18. The concept of teaching, verse 4, verses 8 and 9, and verse 12. And then the concept of seeing, verse 15, 18, and 19.
I just point out, when you go to the book of Psalms, and you pick out an individual psalm, pay attention, because a lot of times the writer repeats himself. He uses key terms over and over again to place the focus where he wants it to and give you his instruction. And he also highlights repetitive themes.
That's helpful, along with recognizing structure. There's really a dual function.
As we reach the end of the psalm and we're going back to where we began, when you come to the final section, not only are you concluding where you began, he also has the whole psalm summed up in that last section.
And so, though we won't have much or really anything new when we get there, it is an embracing of the whole flow. Now, what I would like you to realize also from the beginning is that
what David does is very logical here. He begins crying out for help. This is what drives him to God. It's the occasion. But as he considers his need for help, he also recognizes his need for instruction in the midst of trial. And as he focuses on the concept of instruction from God, he also recognizes his need for forgiveness. When he thinks about his need for forgiveness, he is driven to the gracious character of his God. And having reached the zenith there, focusing on God's graciousness, he returns again to the concept of forgiveness, the concept of instruction, and then concluding his cry for help with everything in proper perspective.
I want to ask this question.
When you come to times of trial, when you get down, as James tells us to do, and pray to our God when we are suffering, is the central focus of our prayer
the goodness and the graciousness of God? Or are our thoughts focused inward? I hope that that will be a good challenge as you approach the concept of prayer modeled after David. Look at verse 1. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. As David begins and he is in trial, this is what drives him to God. He wants to recognize from the very onset that God is Lord. God is King. God is the one who is ultimately in control of things. And that in and of itself is very comforting, regardless of what we face in life, knowing that God reigns. He is the Lord of heaven and on earth. He recognizes us. He sees us. There is never a moment where you escape the eye of God. I think about Job as he would wade through his suffering and through his trials. He spends a lot of time reflecting on the God who is in control of everything. He doesn't understand how it's all going. He doesn't understand how it's going to work out, but he does know who is in control, and that's where David is going to begin. That's going to be his central focus, and it will also be where he concludes. This little section also has a repetition of the concept of shame. David has enemies, likely Saul at this time, who are inflicting it, and they are wanting to utterly humiliate him by destroying his entire life. I want you to think about the burden that this is. David didn't ask to be king. He was called to be king and anointed by God. He's given a mission to become Israel's great king and to bring them into glory, but he has to wait patiently through incredible suffering from a man who hates him because God has chosen him. He has several occasions where he could take Saul's life, but he does not because he is waiting on God's timing. And that's where he finds himself here. He is persecuted relentlessly by someone who wants to destroy him, but he realizes, indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. There's going to be an ironic reversal here. My enemies are wanting to shame me, but I know if I wait on you, they will be shamed and I will be exalted according to God's timing, according to his plan. A reversal concept here is introduced. So he says, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. This is what we refer to often in the Bible as walking by faith rather than by sight. Faith is the ability to trust in what God has stated previously, even though from an earthly standpoint, that looks pointless or it looks hopeless in the moment. Verse 4, make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. God has not hidden his path, his truth, his way from mankind. And there's an awesome blessing in that. A lot of times people depict God as being a God who is out to get them, a God who has hidden everything so that he can trick them and he can afflict them. But David has a different perspective. He's asking for the ways, the path, the truth, the salvation, according to God's timing, as he sees best. When I read this, I can't help but think about Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23, where the prophet would say, it's not within man to direct his own paths, nor to deliver himself from instruction. Salvation belongs and always has belonged to God and to God alone. He is the one who can give us hope and can give us deliverance out of the midst of great trial. And that's exactly what David is needing as he flees being persecuted relentlessly by Saul. So I want to ask the question, whenever we face difficulties and trials, do we turn to God's word for instruction to find out what he would have us to do, where he would have us to look, where he would have us to lean to get through the difficulties as we patiently await for our gracious God to care for us? Verse 6, remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgression. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. The ESV translates the word has said, it's repeated twice here, as the steadfast love. And I think that's a pretty good translation. It's the concept of loyal, faithful love. It's a covenant term. And covenant will pop up in the next session quite boldly. But here he repeats it twice. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your chesed, or your steadfast love. Remember not the sins of my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. David wants God to remember something and also to forget something. Remember your steadfast love, but please forget my sins or my transgressions. As he contemplates on his distress, God being in control, as he asks for instruction according to God's path, he recognizes God is faithful. That's in his nature. He has always been steadfast in his love.
And yet David has not always been steadfast in his love. We want God to act in accordance with his nature and not in accordance with our nature. So this is a very humbling statement here. And he says, for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Notice he is wanting to persevere. He's wanting to triumph over his enemies. He's wanting to walk in God's path and God's truth. He's wanting to receive God's salvation. Why? So that God might be glorified and his name and his character be upheld. He's relying on the good character of God to be maintained as it always has been. Verse 8, good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in his way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness to those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. God wants to raise up those who are afflicted, those who are in sin or transgression, by teaching them his ways. This is a very humbling concept, and it's meant to be so. Sometimes we find ourselves in difficult situations because of our choices and our decisions. Sometimes we find ourselves there despite our good decisions. And yet God is there, centrally focused, his steadfast, loving faithfulness. Now, this is a concept that's borrowed from Exodus chapter 34. If you remember on that scene, Moses goes up onto the mountain, and God passes by as he is hidden there in the rock, and he declares his name. Now, the concepts that he repeats multiple times there are his steadfast love and his faithfulness. And David is relying on this as he brings up the concept of the covenant. For those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. God has been faithful to us. He is long-suffering. Yet he requires us to walk faithfully within the covenant. When we sin, he is faithful to forgive, but he is also requiring that we turn back to him and that we humble ourselves so that we might receive his mercy and forgiveness. There he states, verse 11, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. The greatness of David's sin, or his guilt, is contrasted with the greatness of God's name. God receives glory when people are faithful to him and also when they're unfaithful. He receives glory for showing mercy and steadfast love. He also receives glory when he meets out judgment or justice. And so he's pleading to him here. He's saying, for your name's sake, O Lord, please pardon my guilt, for it is great. So we have to ask, what is it about forgiveness? This is arguing that part of God's nature is to forgive. What is it about forgiveness that is glorifying to God's name? How does that make his name great? I want to read the words of Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verse 9. Therefore, God has highly exalted him, speaking of Christ, and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. God's name is greatly glorified. The greatest moment of glorification was when the Son took on flesh, came to earth and died so that forgiveness might be granted to the whole world. God's name is made great in granting forgiveness through his Son. David was aware of this a long time ago, that God is a gracious and forgiving, a steadfast God, and he's wanting to lean upon that in difficult times, and there's a lot to be said for that. I want to say this. When we face difficulty, be it persecution, be it sickness, we have something that the world doesn't have. We have a relationship with a good God who wants our best and who has promised us salvation, whether that is physically in this life or in the life that is to come. God will be faithful, and we have to lean upon that at all times. Verse 12, who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the ways that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship, or literally counsel, of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. Fear is the driving term that leads this section. A minute ago it was humility, the concept of a man humbling himself. Now it's the concept of a man walking in the fear of God. If we are to receive the instruction that we've prayed for, we have to have a proper attitude of our God and walk in fear. And I want to say this, the two greatest challenges that we face as Christians are maintaining an humble attitude and a reverential fear of God. I don't know that you can overstress the importance of those two concepts. We struggle sometimes when we have sinned, when we are dealing with the consequences of our sin, of humbling ourselves and receiving the consequences that come with it, while also knowing God is a steadfast, loving God. I think about David when he sinned with Bathsheba. He had many consequences that were poured out upon him. The child that they were going to have dies. His kingdom is going to be afflicted with conflict for the rest of his reign. Sometimes it felt more than he could bear. You know what's unique about David? Is that nowhere in 2 Samuel, after his sin, do we see him complaining that it is more than what he can bear. He recognizes he is very humble. He humbles himself and he casts himself on God. There's an occasion at the end of 2 Samuel where David numbers the people, which is against God's will, and God comes to him and says, basically, you got three choices and none of them are good. I can send war from your enemies upon the land. I can give you 7 years of famine. Or I can kill you for 7 days. Which will it be? And David doesn't defend himself like Saul does. He simply admits that he was wrong. And he throws himself on the grace of God. And it appears that though God chose 7 days of persecution directly with the angel of the Lord, which is very reminiscent of Exodus, God was gracious and didn't fulfill the whole 7 days. David chose his gracious God, even in judgment, because God would be faithful and God would be more gracious than his enemies would. In difficult times, he had to humble himself and regain a reverential fear of his God. If we have God in proper perspective and people persecute us for our faith, it doesn't matter. Jesus would say, fear not him who can destroy the body, but fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. When everything is in proper perspective, God is the only one that matters. It does not matter. Whom shall I fear? What shall man do to me? David would say on one occasion. Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. Sometimes we have difficulty knowing what to do because we're relying on our own ingenuity or own insights to get out of trouble rather than going to God and seeking his instruction from his word, humbling ourselves to accept whatever it is that he's commanded us to do and trusting in him that it will lead us safely through to the salvation that he provides through his plan and through his path. He says there, his soul shall abide in well-being and his offspring shall inherit the land. There he comes back to a covenantal term. In Genesis chapter 12, God had promised Abraham that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars of the heaven and the sand of the seashore, and they would inherit the land. He made that same promise to David later in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14. I'll build a house for your son, and they will come and possess the land. It's a concept that the Lord would return to in Matthew chapter 5 in the Beatitudes, as he promises there the inheritance of the land or the earth. This is a blessing, a covenantal concept there. He says, the friendship or the counsel of the Lord is for those who fear them, and he makes known to them his covenant. God has offered covenant relationship with his people if they will humble themselves and if they will walk in the reverential fear of their God. Covenants are blessings that God doesn't have to give. He has graciously offered us what we do not deserve. Yet the covenant also comes with conditions that we have to maintain. We have to live up to our end of the bargain. What you have basically when a covenant was always formed, there was called what's called the cutting of the covenant. This was either literally stated or it's implied in passages, but it's the concept of an animal being divided in half. And the symbolism is that both of the parties are committing, if I violate the covenant, let it happen to me as happened to this animal. God's promising that, and the irony is that God keeps his side of the covenant every time, and yet it was God who died so that the covenant could be upheld. The great, awesome beauty of God's steadfast love demonstrated in his covenant faithfulness through his Son, Jesus Christ, who not only fulfilled the old covenant, but also ushered in a new and bound himself covenantally to us by his shed blood. How fearful of a thing when we partake of the Lord's Supper every Sunday and we remember his blood which ratified the covenant and the seriousness of the relationship that we are now in. Humble humility and fearfulness for the God that we serve. Sometimes I think we struggle with suffering, regardless of what type it is, and we feel like God owes it to us to get us out of the situation that we're in. I was talking with a brother today. I had lunch with him, and he said he was talking to a friend. His friend was reading through the Old Testament for the first time in his life, and he has encountered the angry God and doesn't know what to do with him. He's always had this kind of like Santa Claus version of God in his mind that is all love and all mercy and no wrath. And that kind of gets destroyed right off the get-go from the Bible. That's part of what we read tonight. God destroying the whole world, 8 souls being saved. That's both justice and mercy being poured out. We look at those who die and we say that's not fair of God because we're looking from a human selfish standpoint. We're not thinking about the holiness of God. When you understand the holiness of God, you realize justice and wrath is what we all deserve. It's by God's grace that Noah is saved. I saw a young man one time, one of our members, he put up a meme on Facebook that said, grace didn't save Noah, works saved Noah. And when I read that, I was shocked because the Bible explicitly states, Noah found grace in the eyes of God. Now that required works of humble obedience, but it was grace all along. There is no one ever that will stand before God and tell God that God owes it to them to let them into heaven. God was gracious in forming us. He was gracious in putting up with us. He was gracious in giving his son to die for us so that we might be saved. He is gracious in allowing us time and time and time again to come crawling back to him when we have sin in our life. When we face trials sometimes of our own making, and even the ones that are outside of our making, there is problems in the world because there is sin in the world. How can a good God allow such evil things to happen in the world? That's the question everyone wants to ask, but they got it wrong. Because sin's not in the world because of God. There's hope of salvation in the world because of God. Sin's in the world because man chose to rebel against God. Because man chose death over eternal life with God. Because of the sin we got ourselves into that we cannot cure. And the hope of salvation that we have belongs exclusively to a gracious God who offers a covenant to those who humble themselves and come seeking his love and mercy. David is pouring himself out, reflecting on the unique relationship that he has in difficult times. These were not the first days of difficulty, and they would not be the last of David's. But these are the concepts that have to always be with God's people to help them through times of trial, whatever kind that that is. In the concluding section, as he returns to this cry for help, all these concepts, this concept of forgiveness, seeking your paths, knowing your truth, the covenant, your steadfast love, humility, all those things, the fear of God, come back around and just saturate this passage. Verse 15, my eyes are ever toward the Lord. I'll pause there and ask two questions. One, does that describe you? Your eyes are always toward the Lord. In times of trial, think about David as he's running through the mountains for his life. Always toward the Lord. Why? For he will pluck my feet out of the net. If you trust in God and keep your eyes fixed on him, he brings deliverance. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. From the outside, men are persecuting him. He feels all alone, and he is asking that God would be with him. He says, the troubles of my heart are enlarged. He has difficulties without and within. A lot of times we talk about the physical troubles that we have on the outside, but a lot of times people suffer greatly from the inward struggles, be it from guilt or just the challenges that we face. There is a mental grind that goes on. And sometimes the greatest trials we face are not physical in nature. They're the mental ones. From outside and from within, they bring me out of my distress, he asks. See my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. He realizes I not only need salvation from the things that are coming upon me, but I also need forgiveness for my sin. See how many are my foes and with what violent hatred they hate me. If there was ever a person outside of Christ who could cry out for vengeance against someone, it was David against Saul. Yet David's not crying out for vengeance. He's crying for salvation from God. He's putting it in God's hands and trusting that God will take care of the situation. For with violent hatred they hate me. I don't know that we appreciate so much in this country where we have quite a bit of religious freedom, what it's like to have people violently hating you. That they spend all their time seeking ways, not just so that they can tear you down, not just so that they can make you lose your job, but seeking violently to kill you with every opportunity. Men of great power and wealth, men that from the world standpoint, they have everything, all the resources necessary to do whatever they want to with you. Yet David is looking to someone greater, and he will not take his eyes off the Lord. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in your shelter. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. For I wait for you. That last part, the concept of patience. In the midst of trial, we want deliverance now. We want the affliction to cease now, the violent men to end now. God allows David to go for years in this situation. Jesus spent his whole preaching ministry in this position, often in prayer to God about it. And yet, sometimes the deliverance was through the trial, not that the trial was going to be just miraculously removed. Jesus would say at the end of the Beatitudes, he'd been talking all about what is necessary of kingdom people in general, and he says specifically to the crowd there, you, rejoice and be exceedingly glad when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Think about that concept of waiting for God through trial for the timing of his deliverance, knowing that he will be faithful, but not knowing how it's going to come. And then there's the addendum in verse 22 that you can't miss. He says, redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. It's not just about David. It's about Israel. David is in his situation with Saul for the sake of Israel. And David realizes that whatever he's going through, it's not just he that's suffering. Israel is in a very difficult time. That's something that we have to keep in perspective. Not only our God, but also God's people. As we suffer in life, there are often, if not always, other Christians who are suffering with the same situation. And rather than always focusing on self, David is focused on, number one, is God, but also God's people. And he has a great fervent desire that God would remember his covenantal kingdom, and that in his steadfast, gracious love, he would look down upon them, that he would forgive them and lead them to salvation for his name's sake, so that God might receive the glory that's due him. That's proper perspective, kingdom perspective. The king and his people, what a blessed privilege we have as the people of God. We read about these stories of people like David, and we read these psalms, and sometimes we think, well, those are for different people of a different time, but these are for our people. If anyone suffers, let him pray. If anyone has cheerfulness, let him sing songs of praise to God. Here we have modeled for us a prayer for the difficult season. I hope that is helpful. It's encouraging. It helps put the perspective where it has to be and highlights some key themes that have to be ever on our minds as we wait on God, come what may. If you're here this evening and you have not obeyed the gospel, you don't have the covenant assurances that God has granted. God is being faithful and long-suffering, allowing you moments such as this to turn to him. Turn to him in recognizing your distress and your need for his salvation. He's waiting and ready to help. Come believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, confessing his name and being baptized in water for the remission of sins. When you do that, you are placed inside the covenant, and the rules of the covenant apply to you. If you are a Christian today and you are not living up to the covenant commitment that you made, make that right. God has been gracious and merciful. Yet there are always consequences to covenant violation if we presume upon his grace. Come as we stand and sing.